Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to XYZ, the podcast about CNC, automation, robotics, business, and more. My name is Aaron Goff, owner of Goff Custom Knives, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nick Frank, from the Frank Brothers Guitar Company. How are you, mate?
I'm well. How are you, buddy?
Going good. We're both sounding extra luscious today.
Mm-hmm. You sound very silky.
Ooh. Yes, Nick and I spent a little bit of money on new microphones, and we're making love to all of your ears now.
Wow. Sorry, everybody, for that.
What have you been up to this week, mate?
Well, I've been crushing it in production, gotta say.
Yeah?
Banging out a guitar a day in woodwork. And it feels good.
Oh, amazing, man.
Yeah, that's like as good as we can do.
Awesome. Sorry.
With the team we've got. That's just like, right. That's running at full tilt. And we're like happy with that.
Awesome. So what's your bottleneck now?
It's assembly post-finish routes. Like, you know, we finish the guitars and then we put the humbucker or the whatever pickup and hardware routes in it. And I can do that pretty quick, but it takes me away from the other production stuff. And then, you know, now we've got like half of the plastics on the Haas. We still need to dial in the pick guards, but like the pickup rings are on the Haas, and I was running some today and it's so good.
Nice. That's awesome.
Yeah.
No
so
more,
just
issues with losing vacuum and chucking them.
No, that was sorted. It was such a simple fix. It was stupid that we were resisting it. It's just an op zero.
Right. What did you do in the end? Oh, yes. Yes. You showed me that the other day. Op zero with little pins, right?
Yeah. We just ran two pinholes, which, you know, we can run under vac. We can run that program under vacuum, just making two pinholes. There's not enough like lateral pressure or tool pressure to move the part with that little operation. We are delicate. Don't push it. And yeah, then just flip them and run the rest.
That's
of it.
Awesome.
Yeah, so that feels pretty good.
Nice, man.
Our vacuum did die, though.
Oh, no. Did you get another one already? Or?
We did. So when we first started this project, we swapped vacuums with Mark. We had a little vacuum, like a $500 quarter horsepower type thing. And he gave us his like nice Bush commercial grade vacuum. Was like 17 CFM versus this one's like 6 or something. Anyways, yeah, the nice Bush one busted. It was like 30 years old, but like it would be like a $3,000 vacuum. And so that next day after it bit the dust, I drove out to Mark's place and grabbed the cheap little one back from him. Borrowed it back, and it works fine. And it's 55 decibels. It's 55 decibels. It's like you barely hear it.
Right.
But the other one was noisy.
So, what was the failure mode with the other one? Like, did it seize the motor or
it overheated? We don't know what exactly was the problem. It's an oilless vacuum pump, So
right.
Don't know. Haven't cracked it open yet. But
gotcha.
It was like, it happened when Mark was working here, like running some, like some pickup route, pickup rings. And it just, yeah, just died.
Did it launch any parts?
No, it died in between ops.
Oh, that's good. Ooh, lucky.
So now my debate is, do I go out and buy, like, but do I buy a nice quality one or do I go, because I need to give this one back to Mark. Do I go buy this exact same one for $500? Or do I spend double
yeah.
and get the commercial grade version? And I haven't figured that out yet.
You know what? Like, the thing is, like, you really don't need much flow. If you have good seal and everything, then you need very little flow, which is why, you know, Pearson Work Holding, they make their little vacuum generator. And I think that thing only moves like one CFM.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what they sell to everybody for their vacuum work holding systems, right?
Yes. Now, we do have a kind of lossy system because we're vacuuming wood, which is porous.
Right.
So when I look at the gauge, if when we're doing plastic parts, we're getting like 27, what is it? Something of
inches
mercury.
Of mercury.
Inches of mercury. Thank you. Which is like as good as you can get. That
right.
And
well, with your shitty vacuum pump, that's as good as you can get.
But I think the best you can get in like ever is like not even 30.
Yeah, you get 29. My lab grade vacuum pump will go down to like 29 in a bit.
Right. So, and you know, we probably still have some loss. You know, we're using push to connect fittings. I don't know. Maybe there's some leakage there.
Right.
And but when we do like when we vacuum down a body, we're sometimes at like 17, but it holds right. down. You cannot take that part off if you try.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, so, in terms of oilless vacuum pumps, I think, Gast, G-A-S-T, I think they're in the States. They are kind of the gold standard. I picked up one of their oilless rotary vane vacuum pumps. I think it's a third of a horsepower off eBay for, I think I got it for like $120, but that's like a $1,200 vacuum pump new.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So the one I got a quote for was from Becker, which is German.
Okay.
And that was kind of like the equivalent to Bush, but I haven't heard of Gast. I'm on their website now. I'm going to look into it.
They make tons of little rotary vane pumps. Yeah. And if they have something that'll achieve the level of vacuum you need, then, you know, the other thing is too, like eBay is actually a fantastic resource for that kind of stuff. Like, you really don't want to use a lab grade oil, you know, oil bath pump because you're just going to be exhausting an oil mist all the time. But, I have a Leybold Trivac, D16E lab grade rotary vane vacuum pump, and that thing, as I said, will go all the way down to, I think it'll pull 10 microns of vacuum, which is like, you know, way beyond 29 inches of mercury basically. And I got that thing for $400. They're $6,000 US new.
Ooh, wow, what a steal.
Yeah. So eBay is fantastic for stuff like that.
Yeah, I did scope out some eBay listings, but I haven't pulled the trigger because, I mean, Mark doesn't need this right now. So I'm like, well, right. I'll hold off until he needs it. It's meant for vacuuming veneer, like in a vacuum bag.
Like vacuum bagging. Yeah.
Vacuum bagging. It's from a place called veneersupplies.com.
Okay. So there is a company called Best Value Vax. I bought a vacuum pump from them a while ago. I actually ended up giving it to a friend of mine because he had his one break last minute. I don't know if they have oilless pumps, but they have a lot of oil bath pumps that are very inexpensive.
This is good. You should always know someone with a backup vacuum pump.
Yes, sure.
Value brand
Best Value Vax, BVV.com, I think it's called.
Wow, they must have had that URL forever.
No, actually, they didn't used to have it. I think they must have spent some big cash on it.
BVV.com does not take me to it.
Oh, it's is that a not safe for work website?
No. I'm not sure what it is.
Well, you can Google best value vax yourself then. Yeah, I mean, so I guess it's just the flow that you potentially require that's keeping you away from using like a Venturi vacuum pump, like one that uses.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. We have a lossy system. So also Venturis are really loud. Just reading on McMaster, the decibel ratings are about as high as a rotary vane.
Yeah, I've got a little one you could borrow if you want to try it out.
Okay.
It's not that loud. Like, you wouldn't hear it over your machine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do. You know, I was researching the difference between Venturi and rotary vane or whatever, just a pump. And it does, like, I thought the idea of the Venturi made so much sense for us in terms of, because we have a nice big compressor. But yeah, you know, like our 7.5 horsepower compressor is going to have to turn on every time to generate that vacuum. Now, it's not drawing a lot of CFM, but one third horsepower vacuum pump is probably using less energy.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, honestly, like the biggest advantage to the Venturi pumps is that they have like no moving parts. You know, they can ingest coolant or dust chips or, you know, whatever, and they'll just blow it out rather than getting like, you know, broken by that contamination. So
no, that's a good point. Yeah. So you need like a filter on a pump, especially in our environment.
Yes. Did you have one on the other one that you broke?
Yeah.
You had a filter?
Yes, an air filter. Now, we didn't have a filter from the vacuum side. So it's possible it could have sucked chips or dust in from through the vacuum.
Yeah, that's the important side to have a vacuum on, a filter on.
Right. So we were just trying to be real careful. But right. The air draw from, you know, like just it had a filter somewhere. I don't know.
Well, McMaster sell these really nice little NPT input output cartridge filters for like vacuum work holding and vacuum bagging applications.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I have one that I don't use, which I could probably just gift you if you really need it.
Okay. Well, I'm learning a lot. When we started this, you know, I was like, we just had a vacuum, so I didn't need to think too much about it. Now that I need to like buy a vacuum, right. I'm starting to learn my shit.
Yeah, that's fair.
We need to drop like 1,000 to 1,500 bucks US. Because the other thing I've been looking into getting is that Pearson vac alert that you can hook up to your we can hook it up to the Haas controller.
Right. And it'll throw an alarm if you lose vacuum, right?
Yeah, in a fraction of a second. You can set the vacuum, the like inches of mercury too. You can set it to like, you know, say, you know, because we have a lossy system, we're not going to be holding 26 all day. We set it to 17. And if it goes below 17, it'll hold, stop the machine. Cause we had a power outage here and we lost vacuum, but the spindle was spinning. It spun for like 10 minutes. Right.
Right.
And because we lost vacuum, the part lifted up like, I don't know, 15 thou into the spindle, the spinning spindle at the end mill.
Right.
So it just like left a little low part. It wasn't in a critical area, so it was fine. But I don't want that happening. Yeah.
Yeah, that's fair.
So that's what's been up with us. What have you been saying?
Not too much, man. I'm just kind of trying to get caught up still, just cranking through. I've been doing a lot of the glow-in-the-dark stuff. And that, honestly, it's just been super painful. Like, you know, I started with the pressure pot for casting them, and that didn't work. And then I moved over to the vacuum degassing, and that works, but it takes longer. and then the supplier that I buy the like translucent G10 from for making these, you know, handle scales, mm-hmm. they just haven't had any of that material in like 2 months.
Ah, fuck.
Yeah, so thankfully I found a, funnily enough, McMaster sells, I know they sell G10, but it's actually kind of a pain to get this particular color. It's like a translucent green. So it's like one of the natural kind of colors that G10 comes in. Hmm. But, you know, a lot of companies kind of seem to add colorants and stuff. They don't quite leave it natural. Mm-hmm. So I had to like buy, I think I bought like 4 or 5 different, you know, G10 samples off McMaster that said they were green until I found the one that's actually like, you know, natural fiberglass and epoxy color. You know, it's translucent.
And so is that working for you?
It looks great.
Sick.
Yeah, it looks okay. Great.
Well, if you can buy it from McMaster, so you're, I'm sure you're happy.
Yeah, exactly. Gotta love it. Yeah, so I'm back up and running with that. Made a bunch of those today when they came out. Awesome, which is fantastic.
Sweet.
I did have some fun the other day doing machining of the glow in the dark handle scales in the dark. Like I turned out all the lights. Because the glow in the dark material actually will start glowing from heat as well.
No way.
Like if you pass a blowtorch over it, it'll glow. Yeah. So wherever the end mill is cutting it, the you know, it's heating up the glow in the dark material and it glows. So it's throwing off these awesome like glowing chips.
Oh, that's so cool. Did you video that?
I spent some time. I have a really a couple of really nice old school manual lenses that can be adapted onto my camera, and one of them is like a really really fast lens that pulls in a lot of light.
Sick.
So yeah, I can take like photos and video with that in like almost, you know, pitch black. So yeah, I was able to get some wicked looking footage of that. So I'm going to do a video that shows like the whole process start to finish, and that's definitely going to be in there. So.
Sick. We are wrapping up the glow in the dark side dot guitar.
Oh, sweet.
That you helped out with.
How'd it turn out?
Awesome. I mean, the color match is pretty fucking good. So, cause I mixed the, like a pigment with your glow in the dark powder. Got it from the supplier you recommended. Mm hmm. And I'm trying to give you credit. I mean, only in this,
only give me more credit.
Only in this forum, and everywhere else, I'll be taking the credit myself.
Fine.
But yeah, so I mixed in a certain amount of blue, and I color matched it to the color sample he gave us, and then Tim had to shoot the color to match the color sample he gave us too. So we kind of did it independently because it was more important that the actual guitar color be really dialed into the color sample that we were given.
Yeah, sure. The dots are very small. It's kind of hard to tell.
Yeah. So he didn't, you know, use those as a reference, but they didn't end up looking pretty similar, pretty close.
Cool.
And they glow beautifully.
Yeah, man. Yeah. So like what Nick's is saying basically is that the glow in the dark powder that I use is kind of a very pale green to white in daylight, and most people use it and just leave it like that. But I've actually been adding like a pigment to it so I can adjust the daylight color. And so Nick did the same thing, but rather than adding the kind of bright neon green like I do, he actually added, it was like a duck egg blue, right? Like it was a really light.
It was a greenish blue. Yeah. I don't know. It's right. called faded pelham is what we're going for. Right. Or aged pelham. But yeah, it was like a bluish green. And the fact that it was already green actually helped me.
Yeah.
Because it lent that
green. Yeah, and it's super cool. It's super cool having something that glows in the dark and has a really nice daylight color. That's kind of unusual. So
yeah, you would never guess the stuff. I mean, you know what? That's not true. Like the supplier that makes this for guitars, like they make a side dot, has a blue, but it's a little bit more electric, I'd say. This looks a little bit, you know, you wouldn't really suspect it to be a glow in the dark material.
Glow in the dark thing. Right.
But yeah, I mean, maybe I'm too close to it. to me, it looks completely different than their blue. But it's similar to the way they did it. I actually piped it into a black tube. So it's got a black ring around the glow in the dark blue, and then it's that's inlaid into a white bound fretboard.
Very cool.
Yeah, I'm happy with
that. Yeah, man, it's cool stuff. There's something about glow, like the really bright glow in the dark, that just, I don't know, makes you feel like a kid again. You're like, oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, sick. It's like, how does that work? Why?
Yeah.
It's kind of makes you wonder.
Magic.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, very cool.
It's like magnets, man. How do magnets work?
How do they even? One thing we should get to is that I left you guys on a cliffhanger last week when I said I had been talking to machine reps.
Ooh.
However, what I should say is I've been trying to talk to machines. So Nick, I had a bit of a chat about this afterwards. Yeah, still nothing. So I contacted Doosan. You know, I filled out one of their contact forms online. And then, you know, I waited for the local Doosan rep to get a hold of me. And one of their guys called me 2 days after that. And I was like, oh, you know, had a bit of a chat. Nice, great. He's like, oh, I'll send you all the information. And I'm like, thank you. Great. I'm looking forward to it. Nothing. Mm-hmm. And then like a week later, I get a call from like the Doosan rep, like their local rep's owner. And he is talking to me like they've never talked to me before. And then he's like, oh, I'll get you in touch with the rep in your area. And I'm like, oh, okay. I thought I'd already, you know, okay, fine. And then nothing. You know, so it's been this really weird like mix of kind of reasonably responsive contact and then like zero follow-up, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Which is a bit of a shame because Doosan just launched a new machine called the BVM 5700, if memory serves right. And it's basically like their version of the Okuma Genos M560V, you know, so it's a double column mill with a stationary tool changer off to the side and like a big plus spindle. And it looks like a beast. It looks like a real beast. But my understanding is that it's substantially less expensive than the Okuma. And they have introductory pricing on it at the moment.
Right. That would be sweet to take advantage of that. I wonder what substantially less expensive is, though. Like $20,000?
I've got no idea because they didn't follow up with me.
God, that's so annoying. I want to know a fucking price. That's what everybody wants seriously. To know. And everyone hates that machine tool builders don't list their pricing, except for a few. I get it. But you just want to know, right? So then that way you can dream, and then when that dream becomes a little closer to reality, it gives you something to work towards.
Yeah, you have, you know, it really helps to have a number in mind for sure. So yeah, that's been a bit painful, and especially in comparison with Haas, you know, when I reached out to Haas, they like had a rep in my shop like the next day, you know. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's a little bit painful in comparison. Doosan also has another machine which I'm interested in called the SVM 4100, which is again another new machine, and that's designed to, it basically competes with the Haas VF2, you know, so I think it's 30x16, you know, category machine, except it's like really fast. It's designed for like, you know, it has a lot of stuff that the VF2 would be like an option on the VF2.
Right.
So I'm just like pulling it up now. Yeah. 1400 inches a minute rapids, 0.6 G acceleration on all the axes, 708 inches a minute cutting speed. It comes with a 30 tool side mount tool changer as standard. And it's a Cat 40 dual contact spindle, 12,000 RPM. Direct drive standard.
So it's more like their SS, like a VF2 SS.
I guess so, yeah. But it works out to be less expensive.
Oh, really?
It's 74K US.
So how'd you get a price for this?
So for some reason, they list the price for this one on their website, but no, they don't list prices for anything else.
And so, give us the model number again. SVM 4100?
SVM 4100, yeah. So it's a nice looking little machine.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that being said, you know, so I've talked to you for years about how I really wanted to get the finishes off my machine good enough that I didn't have to do as much hand sanding, because hand sanding is kind of like ruining my body. Like literally my right arm is like in constant pain now from all the hand sanding I've done.
Is it jacked though?
It's no, it's not. It's probably getting wimpier than the other one. And I've actually gotten really close to that in the last couple of weeks. It turns out that Fusion has this setting that they don't really talk about much when you're setting, when you're creating toolpaths. They just call it tolerance. And I always assumed, you know, we think of tolerance as like, oh, machinist tolerance, you know, plus, minus, thousandth, whatever. But I did some digging on that. And it turns out that when Fusion is making toolpaths, you would think that it's like making the toolpath directly on the solid model, right? Following the curves of the solid model. Mm-hmm. Makes sense. But that's not what's happening. It's actually making a mesh. So kind of like you would with an STL, it's making like a polygon mesh of the model first, and then it's creating the toolpaths from the mesh. And that tolerance setting actually controls the maximum allowable error between the mesh and the solid model. So previously I had that set to like a 1/10th of an inch, and I always thought that'd be okay, you know, and it turns out it's really, really not, you know. So I have that setting. I recently changed it so that that setting is 1/100th of a micron. And all of a sudden I'm seeing better surface finishes.
Yeah. You sent me a photo and the surface looks great.
Yeah. 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 So it's kind of, I'm going to do a video on this too, because it's a really non-intuitive setting. Like, you wouldn't think that you would have to go that tight in order to get a good result, but it just kind of stacks up in an unfavorable way if you don't go really tight, you know? So mm-hmm. That's been super interesting. And it kind of means that maybe I don't need a new machine, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, imagine if you had that plus a new machine. I just like new shiny things. So, but
yeah, who doesn't? Well, I mean, I've talked to you about this offline a little bit, but there's a company called CalMotion that make a replacement controller for the Fidals, and it's literally cards. So, you know, you have the kind of control cards in the cage in the back cabinet on the Fidal. You just pull three of those out, put the new ones in, attach a couple of little cables, and then you're up and running. It's like literally a 5-minute installation. Mm-hmm. It's about $6,000 US, and then there's a core charge if you don't send them your cards. And for my machine, that would double the resolution that the control has on each axis. And it does like full acceleration and deceleration control, which the original Fidal control does not do. And it enables, like, you know, gigs of storage for programs. Mm-hmm. Increases the, so the Fidal control can only handle 250 lines a second of code. The replacement control can handle 6,000 lines of code a second.
So yeah, it's
a pretty substantial upgrade. Kind of. It has the acceleration and deceleration, so it basically like looks ahead to the next, you know, move or two, and works out whether or not it needs to accelerate or decelerate. Hmm. Which the original Fidal control does not do
either. Which could help your surface finish.
It might be that
it might shake a little, like as it rams into that end of the line.
It does.
Yeah,
it does. Yeah. Yeah. So what the Fidal, the original control does, it basically just tries to change direction instantaneously. And then it knows that while it's doing that, the servo is going to, like, you know, have a follow, what they call a following error. So, you know, it's trying to keep to a certain position, but it can't. So it falls behind, and it basically just lets the servos fall behind up to a certain amount, you know, which might be 0.5 thou or, you know, 0.4 or whatever. Yeah. Whereas this control does that to a much lesser extent. It's like, oh, I see that I'm trying to make a 180 degree change in direction, so I'll slow down to 5 inches a minute and then reverse direction.
You know? Right.
So yeah, it might be that, you know, I just need that little bit of an extra bump. That plus the tolerance, tighter tolerance settings in Fusion 360. As we've said before, like $6,000 once off is so much nicer than. Mm-hmm. You know, a $2,000 a month machine payment for the next 5 years or whatever.
Yeah, that sounds like a no-brainer.
Yeah, so I'm right now, I'm not going to be doing that this year because I need to kind of keep my numbers up for this year for the bank so that I can get a mortgage next year.
Fucking bank.
Which is stupid, but I know it's stupid. You got to play the game though. So yeah, start of next year, I'll be looking into that though for sure.
Yeah, that's huge. Sweet.
Yeah, and also we had a great feedback from one of our listeners after the last episode. So Protium Machining, remember last episode I was talking about the power grip system? It's that super fancy collet with the hydraulic...
Rigofix. Is that the same thing?
Yeah, it's... No, I think it's made by Rigofix.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Power Grip. Anyway. Yeah. Anyway. The machine, the tooling rep that came in, it came to my shop to tell me about that, said it was like $30,000 to get into it. And Protium Machining says that like that price is way off. He said you can get a set with like 10 holders and the hand pumped hydraulic unit for like $6,000. So either the rep misspoke or was thinking of a different system or whatever. So if anyone's interested in that system and was discouraged by the last episode, that's an update for you.
Yeah. US to Canadian conversion isn't that good, but I don't think that 6 to 30 is it.
I wish it worked that way. Got to keep our US dollar prices, you know.
True. Well, that's exciting because that's a pretty wicked looking system.
Yeah. There's like no slits or anything in the collets for like crap to get into.
Yeah.
You know, it's basically like taking two tapered solid pieces of steel and smushing them together so hard that they deform and hold the tool, mm-hmm. which is pretty
amazing. Yeah, I've played with one. It's pretty kick-ass.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, Mark has that, has one. He bought it on eBay for really cheap. And
oh, nice.
He was saving up to buy a CNC that had, I think, I forget what the tool holder size was. It was with these little guys.
BT30 or yeah, ISO 20 or something?
It was, yeah, ISO 20 maybe? Yeah, I don't know. I can't remember. So,
okay.
Anyways, I tried it with his little hand pump thing. It's fun. It's cool. Right. Big Kaiser has some, like, I was checking out their website. They also have some interesting tool holding options. That look like they aren't just a standard collet with slits. That they might not
right
allow chips or dust or debris in. But I've heard their stuff is expensive.
Right. Honestly, between the like, you know, my masking tape hack where I'm like literally hole punching a hole into some masking tape and then covering the face of the collet with that, and using bearing nuts. You know, so the reason the bearing nuts are interesting is because they don't, if there's any contamination, they don't scrape it against the front of the collet.
Right, because that thing spins.
That contact face is allowed to rotate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. Between those two things, it's made a big difference. I don't seem to be scarring collets up.
Well, if you can do it cheap, that's the best way to do it for now. Yeah, the Big Kaiser stuff was called Mega Double Power Chucks. Mega Perfect Grip.
Ooh.
High Power Milling Chucks. They've got all these options. And they just they kind of look like the like hydraulic, like the Mary tool one. I don't actually know how they work, but anyways, something to look into.
Protium Machining was saying I should be looking at the Uber Chuck as well, is it's a cool system. It has like a worm gear that's kind of like the hydraulic tool holders, you know. There's like an external kind of hex drive that has like a worm gear on the inside, and then there's like a ring gear that has like a threaded thing that pulls the collet in from the back of the collet.
Oh.
And the collets do have slits in them, but they're really small. They're like a wire EDM kind of slit, you know, not like the kind of saw cut slits that you see on like an ER collet.
Right.
And yeah, they look really interesting actually. If the price is okay, I'd be willing to try those out.
This is a Royal product? Like the same people that make like the Royal?
I think they're sold by a few people.
Okay.
But yeah, if you look up Uber Chuck.
How many umlauts in that?
Unlimited umlauts.
Okay. Well, it just seems there's only one. What a shame. Yeah, that sounds cool. I've heard of that once before. I mean, you get a lot of other Uber stuff going on here. Uber Eats. I'll have to look into that more.
You've got a hard out soon, so there's something I want to get to. We've got some space news that we should get to.
Space. Cool.
Space news. So one interesting thing happened this week, which I really wasn't expecting to see. Russia tested an anti-satellite weapon.
Wow.
Blew up one of their old satellites.
Shut up.
But turns out they didn't really check where the International Space Station was going, because the debris cloud that they created bisects the orbit of the ISS. So the ISS astronauts have been like in their emergency shelters for the last couple of days.
Holy shit. You know, it's like that, one of these, that movie Gravity.
Yeah, exactly. Because like when up there, you know, there's no air or anything to slow stuff down. So you've got all this debris, you know, going around the planet, like, you know, Mach 10 or whatever, like an incredible velocity. So like, you know, a little bolt or something is like 10 times more energy than a bullet, you know? So you don't want to get tagged by anything. And yeah, for some reason, Russia thought it was totally fine to like fill a whole orbital lane with bits of debris.
How will it ever stop spinning at that speed?
Yeah, there, you know, there are stray gas molecules and stuff up there that, you know, they will interact with the Earth's magnetic field very weakly. There are forces that will eventually slow them down. And that happens to like the ISS as well. You know, every, I don't know how often they have to do this, like at least once a year or something, they have to do what's called an orbit raising burn. So they actually kind of speed themselves back up, put themselves back up into an higher orbit. And anything that isn't actively doing that will eventually fall back into the Earth's atmosphere. But depending on the height of the orbit, it can take years, potentially decades.
Damn. In the meantime, so, I hope they're being safe up there.
Yeah, me too. Can you imagine, like, you know, regular day at work and then all of a sudden they're like, yeah, you could have a cloud of bullets coming through your office any moment. Maybe right under your desk.
Quite call it, yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. Cloud of bullets. That's what it should be called.
That's cool. It's a good band name.
yeah, it is a good band name. So, yes, hopefully they stay safe. I haven't heard any terrible news in the last day or two, so I think things are still fine. But, yeah, it was a bit touchy there for a minute.
So how did they blow this thing up? With, like, a laser beam or something?
No, it's basically like a rocket. Super-fast missile that's, like, launched from the ground. Yeah.
It's almost disappointing. Basically
a big-ass...
Should be a laser beam.
Well, so the old school... The new school way of doing it is that the missiles are super accurate, you know, so they can launch this missile and use like a regular explosion and take it out, you know. But back in the day, like the 80s or whatever, when they first started making anti-satellite weapons, they didn't have that level of precision with the guidance. So the answer was to use a really big bomb. So the original anti-satellite weapons were all nuclear tipped.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Okay. So but, this is,
you know, it's better, I guess.
Safety first.
Safety first.
Although yeah, apparently not.
Missiles into space. So, okay, speaking of safety first, I think the coolest space thing, this is the thing I'm really excited about talking about. There's a company called Spin Launch that just, I think it was a week ago, had their subscale demonstrator test, which was successful. So Spin Launch... Their like motto should be yeeting things into space.
What does that mean?
Like launching, just chucking stuff into space.
Oh.
You know, because they are literally, what they're doing is, did you ever do like shot put or discus when you're in like high school?
No.
No. Okay. So you basically like hold a big metal ball and you spin around, and then once you've done a couple of spins, you let it go and launch it. Mm-hmm. And that's basically what they're doing, but they're launching shit into space.
Whoa, that's fucked up.
Yeah, so they have this giant building that looks like a snail. And inside there, there's a big arm attached to a motor. And on the end of the arm is their little spaceship, you know. So they're not launching big stuff. They're launching like little cube satellites and that kind of stuff, you know, a couple of feet on a side, whatever. Mm-hmm. And right now they're not actually launching anything. They're still in the development phase. But, they're not actually launching anything to space. They did launch their first thing to suborbital altitudes. But the next step is to build a bigger version of this machine and launch stuff into space. So they have this arm that they slowly spin up, you know, over the course of hours, they spin it faster and faster and faster. And on the end of the arm is their little spaceship looking thing. It looks basically like a big bullet. And then, you know, this big building looks like a snail, and the kind of the head of the snail is a chimney that points, you know, straight up into the sky. And they just, at the exact right moment, they just let go of their, you know, little spaceship bullet thing.
That's unreal.
And it zips right out the chimney and goes, you know, into space. The engineering involved in this thing is, it's super cool because a lot of engineering
straight
goes
up
into rockets.
That's fucked up.
Pardon?
It goes straight up.
Yeah, just goes whoop. So when it left, so the whole snail building thing where the arm and everything is actually in a vacuum, like a really pure vacuum, because otherwise at those speeds, you'd be just building heat from all the friction of the air. So then over the little chimney, they basically have like a plastic sheet to keep the vacuum in. And then they just chuck the, you know, the bullet / spaceship through this plastic sheet
right
into the air and up into orbit. But even their subscale demonstrator, it was, you know, when it went through the plastic sheet and left the chimney, it's already doing greater than the speed of sound. Like, it's super, super fast.
This is I see the photo of it breaking through the plastic.
Yeah. Yeah. So everybody, I'm going to put the link to this in the show notes, but if you just look up Spin Launch on YouTube,
great name.
There's a great video by, it gets the point across straight away. There's a great video by a space commentator named Scott Manley, just kind of covering the whole thing. But I just love the idea that you're just gonna like whip stuff into space.
Yeah, why the hell not? So you don't need rocket fuel.
You do need a little bit. They have like a second stage, like a kick stage.
Okay.
But basically, like 90% of the fuel that you use, or maybe not 90%, but it's a pretty high percentage of the fuel that you use, is just, you know, in the first couple of kilometers in the air, trying to, you know, get that speed up from, you know, trying to get your rocket up into space. So to just like chuck it up there instead, you need so much less fuel. You can just have a tiny little rocket, get the last little bit of momentum you need to get into orbit.
Could you ever chuck a person into space this way?
Okay. So when you're spinning around and around in the little vacuum chamber, whatever they're launching at full scale will experience 10,000 Gs.
So no, you would crush your body.
You could, but it would straight up liquefy you. It would liquefy your bones. You could launch a person into space this way, but they're not coming back.
Right. So they won't be test launching a monkey into space, I imagine. They know this. They know it's...
No.
Okay. No.
Not unless you want a monkey pancake.
I'm good.
But yeah, I love, you know, there's been lots and lots of talk about this for, you know, many, many years. Ever since World War II, basically people, like, there was a project in the States where they were like, can we just make a really big gun and shoot stuff into space?
Right.
And the answer is maybe. They tried. They got like, you know, pretty far into this process. But I think I don't know why that project was canceled. I think maybe it was a funding issue or, you know, something. But yeah, like, these guys are actually doing it, which is awesome. I love that there's, you know, other very creative approaches to getting stuff into space.
It looks great.
Yeah. Well, honestly, it's funny. Like, so Scott Manley, in his video, he actually noted that one of the most awesome uses for this is actually not on Earth. So imagine if we have like a mining station on Mars, or sorry, not on Mars, on the moon, and we're, you know, mining valuable stuff, lithium or whatever, rather than having to use a rocket to send that stuff back to Earth, you could just literally chuck it from the moon back to Earth.
And would that the fact that it's zero gravity, is it already a vacuum? Like,
it's already a vacuum on the moon. It's not zero gravity, but it's much lower gravity than on Earth. So the machinery wouldn't need to be as extreme.
Right.
Ah. Yeah. So, I mean, that could be a really cheap way to get stuff from the moon back to Earth and make lunar mining more feasible.
Well, and if it doesn't work out for them, they could just make the smaller and turn it into a really cool kid's toy.
I want one. I definitely want one.
I want to spin launch a drone into just the sky. I guess that's not necessary.
Yeah. Come on, just spin launch everything. Apples.
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm sure you could make some interesting food by spin launching it onto a hot plate.
Well, if you're going to do 10 G's, you could make a pancake out of something.
Actually, speaking of that, if you want to see a gratuitous but very fun video on YouTube, there's a channel called Smarter Every Day, and he recently made a cannon that launches baseballs at 1,000 miles an hour.
Oh, cool.
Because why not?
That sounds dangerous.
And he asked his viewers what he should be shooting, and one of them told him to shoot a gallon of mayonnaise. So if you want to see 1,000 mile an hour baseball hit a gallon of mayonnaise, yeah, check out Smarter Every Day on YouTube. That is a hilarious video. And on that note, I think you've got to go, don't you, Nick?
Yeah, I do. I got to go.
You've got to go like 1,000 mile an hour baseball.
I wish I could get spin launched home. I got to take the streetcar.
your family would receive a liquid. Maybe that's a bad idea.
I'll stick with the streetcar.
Yeah, slower but safer. Mm-hmm. All right, everyone. Well, yeah, I love that. So everyone go look at the spin launch thing and yeah, tell us what you think of it. I think it's awesome. Just the engineering, and like, they had to machine this giant rotor and make this giant vacuum chamber.
Oh, yeah.
I bet there's whip stuff into space, you know? Cool. Like,
yeah, but there's some really cool parts being machined.
Oh yeah. Absolutely.
I love the graphics.
Go check it out.
Tell us what you think. It seems unfathomable, like, that they could release this at the exact right millisecond.
Millisecond. Yeah.
Because
if something goes wrong, they're basically just launching a big bullet through their super expensive housing. Yeah. Yeah.
Cool. All right.
Very cool. Well, have a good night, man. And everybody, we will see you again in 2 weeks.
Lovely
talking to you all, and speak to you again soon.
Cheers.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.